Welcome. This is James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. It is the 10th day of October 2011, and today I am honored to be joined on the line once again by our regular weekly guest Bob Chapman of the International Forecaster at intforecaster.com. Bob Chapman, always a pleasure. Thank you for taking the time.
Well, thank you for having me again, and there's always lots going on, and over the weekend we have been informed that Mr. Sarkozy, who's the PM of France, and the Chancellor in Germany, Mrs. Merkel, they have some grandiose plan that is going to supposedly work to save Europe. And with that, the euro is up almost 2 pennies this early Monday. And that's a large move. And so there are those that think that perhaps this will work. Well, anything that they would do really would just kick things down the road a bit. During the weekend as well, we had been informed that Dexia Bank, which is a combination of activities of the French and Belgian governments, created two sets of books. In other words, they took all the bad assets, I think it was $5.4 billion, and they put them into a subsidiary bank, we'll call it. And this is what all these banks have been doing in Europe and the United States for over 3 years now. I would call it real double entry bookkeeping, because each bank has two sets of books, the good assets and the bad assets. And the justification for the bad assets being in a subsidiary, we'll call it, is that they'll just be written off over the next 50 years on the balance sheet of the good bank. And of course, let me put it this way, if you and I did it, we'd end up in jail. But all the banks are doing it. And many corporations as well, you just don't hear about it. And it was approved by the U.S. government, the European Central Bank, and also the FASB, which is an accounting organization in the United States, as well as the Bank for International Settlements. And, of course, the BIS is calling for more stringent rules and more capitalization for the banks to fend off financial problems in the future. And that's something they've been asking for from the banks. And that's a voluntary group. They all join it and say that they're going to follow what they want them to follow. But they really can act independently if they choose. So nothing has changed in Europe. The only thing that they can do with debt, like in Greece, is to put it in something like a subsidiary where all the debt goes, the bad debt. And I might think that some of the debt from other nations will slide into that category as well. And that would include Ireland and Portugal and perhaps Belgium and Italy and Spain, which are not in very good condition. And so I think maybe, and I'm only guessing, that would probably be the route they would take. And whether it'll be legal or not remains to be seen. The Dexia had been a large buyer of U.S. corporate, government, and municipal paper. And their, I guess you'd call it a bankruptcy, and the shift of bad assets into to the bad bank, so to speak, that's going to affect financing in the U.S., and I was writing about that today. And, you know, one of the things that people forget, and unless they've been in this business a long time, they're not cognizant of the fact that when someone like the Fed has to come in and buy treasury paper and agency paper, which is the bonds of Freddie, Fannie, FHA, and Ginnie, when they do that, it's because other people, Americans as well as foreigners, will not do the purchasing in those items. And what happens is this demand for capital by government and government entities crowds out commercial borrowing, and in this case, actually sovereign borrowing as well, in Europe. Anything that's got a high return, a high interest rate of 5, 6, 7%, something like that, they get affected first, which includes the junk bond market. And junk bonds have done nothing but go down for some time. And this movement away from the capital being available to go into those markets and buy that kind of paper is putting a lot of pressure on real interest rates worldwide. And there's very little activity in that market right now. And, of course, the bonds have come down and the yields have gone up. And that teaches people, you know, you chase the yield, you get what you pay for. And I tell people to never do it. I mean, you want the smallest yield because it's the safest paper. I know I made the mistake about 30 years ago, maybe even longer, in taking the other side of the market and learning a darn good lesson. But anyway, this is very integral to what's going on in Europe. And people don't understand that. And, you know, where is all this money going to come from? It's going to have to be created. It's going to be inflationary. And it's going to make gold and silver go up. I mean, with all this supposed good news today about Sarkozy and Merkel, the markets are up. The FTSE's up 53 points, which is the equivalent of almost 100 Dow points. And the Dow's up 120 or 30 and so on. And the commodities are back up, and so is the gold and silver. In fact, gold's been flirting with $30 for the last 4 hours. So with that said, you can see that they can't, even though the central banks are in the markets manipulating them, they can't control gold and silver and commodities. As much as they try, oh, they can knock them down, they go right back up again. And do they really want to have to do that every day? No, they don't. And they're not capable of doing that. The markets are too big for them. So I don't think that this Sarkozy, Merkel, miracle, we'll call it, is going to work. And I think what you're seeing here is a little euphoria, and the market will turn around and go back down again, and gold and silver and commodities will move back up again. It's sort of like a game. It's a very serious game. But those are the highlights financially out of Europe. And then the pre-opening market in the United States, which is about an hour and 18 minutes away. In the Dow, it's about 18 minutes away in the commodity market. And as you people probably know, I was a stockbroker for many years, and I was never registered to do commodities. But that's really all I dealt with. But I didn't deal with them in the commodity market. I dealt with them in shares. So I have a great familiarity with what goes on in those markets. It's a natural extension of what I did for a long time. Anyway, with that said, it looks like gold and silver are going higher. Commodities are going higher. Oil's up $1.60 today. And they get down, I guess, as much as $74 a barrel. And a good benchmark for oil to sell at any is probably $80. And it could go as high as $120. And there are those that are calling for $200 and $300. I don't think you'll see that unless there's war in the Middle East, which would affect the oil situation there. And short of that, it's trading in a reasonable range between $75 and $120 a barrel.
Well, absolutely. As you mentioned there, of course, we have been documenting month after month after month after month now that they keep trying to hammer down gold and silver, which keep ballooning up because of the inflationary measures that they're taking. And just more signs of the type of hammering they're doing. I saw a recent edition of Fareed Zakaria's GPS on CNN, the establishment CFR mouthpiece, where he had a whole segment on, oh, is gold a bubble? Yes, it must be, because gold is in itself a worthless commodity to have, and there's no reason anyone should want to take physical possession of it, yada yada yada. So I think they are really going on that bandwagon and trying to do their best to hammer it down. But let's back up a moment, because you mentioned the euphoria generated by this supposed Merkel-Sarkozy deal, but as far as I'm aware, really, all they've done is announced that they will unveil a plan at the G20 summit in November. Do we have any inkling of what exactly it is they're planning, or any foreknowledge of what they're going to reveal?
Not at all, but I would guess it'll be to extend the problem. And the only way they can really do that is by printing more money and allowing the banks two sets of books and the banks within a country, let's take Germany as an example, would be protected, ring-fenced, as it's called. And I discussed this in Sadi's issue, which is a few days ago. And what they're doing, they and France both, and I'm sure the others will, is protecting the viability of the banks within their country. In Germany, they have what they call Landesbanks, and their savings and loans. And they own piles of bad paper, particularly these mortgage securities, CDS and MBS. And they probably will be nationalized. And you can understand why a nation would do that, because they don't want everybody going under, creating chaos, and losing their money. They are insured that the amounts are small. I'll guess it's something like $28,000 an account. And in Europe today, that's not very much. When you can rent an apartment in say, Los Angeles for $1,500 a month, and in Europe, it's about $3,000 a month, so you get the drift there. The continued action of government, and I think this is the way they're going to be headed, will be the nationalization of bad banks. In other words, they'll take the good assets and put them in, let's say, Deutsche Bank. We'll use as an example, not that they have this problem that I know of. And what you would do is take all the good assets and leave them in Deutsche Bank, and then have Deutsche Bank B over here. And that's where all the crummy assets would go, and the German government would guarantee them. Who is the German government? It's the German people. So the people who don't have money in a bank, maybe, are guaranteeing the people who do have money in a bank. It's not a very good solution. And that's what I think their answer is going to be. And basically, it's legal, and it's not going to solve the problem. It's going to put great downward pressure on the economies, because its capital will have to be created to offset the debt which is in the bad banks. And it could last for 20 years. And at the same time, they're going to have quantitative easing of some kind to keep the economy from going to, say, -5 or -10 instead of a level or a plus GDP. And when they do that, as we earlier pointed out on the program, it's very inflationary. And they're stuck. I mean, you look at the Swiss, who are not part of the EU, who are not part of the Eurozone. They pegged the currency about a month ago, devaluing it about 15%. They pegged it versus the euro. The euro goes down in value because it's terrible problems, because let's say everything doesn't work out very well. What happens next is that the Swiss franc goes down, and what happens then is they have to do the same thing that Europe and the U.S. is doing. They have to create more money in credit. And that's what makes a bubble in real estate and a bubble in business. They're just not good. See, everybody's trying to avoid purging the system by getting rid of all the bankrupt entities and everybody taking their losses. And they don't want to do that. It's not politically expedient. And the powers behind government that control them don't want them to do that, because then they lose the power to control. And that's what this is all about.
Well, on that note, you note in the recent edition of the Forecaster that consumer confidence last week capped the worst quarterly performance in more than 2 years when the U.S. economy was still in a recession. So I think there's all sorts of people saying things about recovery and worrying about the recovery and all of this. But I think people at a certain instinctual level know that this is not a time of recovery and that we're being lied to basically out the yin yang by the Fed and everyone involved in these positions of power who just want to keep people on that treadmill and as if nothing's really catastrophic happening right now.
Well, I think that this is being reflected in part by these Occupy Wall Street situations, don't you?
Absolutely, absolutely. I think that's very much the first manifestation of what I think is going to be a long and protracted sort of struggle that's going to take place. And I have a lot of things to say about this, but I'm interested to hear about you. So what do you have on intelligence about the Occupy Wall Street movement?
Well, we have a backgrounder. It's around 27 or 8 pages or something like that. And it gives a background of some of the people involved. The financing, from what we can see, is coming from George Soros, who is a member of the Illuminati. So this is an official effort by the Illuminists to get the pot boiling. Secondly, most of the people are radical leftists of one form or another. I'll just leave it at that. And when I saw Bill Ayers up front as one of the founders, I know him from back in the 60s and 70s, and he was a leader of left-wing causes. I always thought he was a communist, but that was my opinion. And so with that said, you figure, well, what are they doing? Well, first of all the things they say is wrong are correct. All their solutions are wrong. They look like they were promulgated by Karl Marx. Very undoable. They've attracted a lot of people, especially college people, and who are disturbed about the lack of jobs, the money they paid for education, the fact that they may have to live at home for the next 20 or 30 years until their parents die and then they take over the house or whatever. And then you have a general group of the public who's joined in saying, yeah, these guys are right, not looking at their solutions, obviously, because then I think they would disagree. But it is a way to go out and vent the way you feel about things. And I've said late last week on other programs that what middle of the road and conservatives should do is join in the party and change the message. That's the most intelligent thing to do. Because I think where they're headed with this, and I know the Marxist-Leninist mindset, which was created by the Illuminists, I know what it's all about. And what they're looking for here is demonstrations all over the United States, Canada, maybe the world for that matter. And they want to turn them, this is my opinion, into radicalization, wild, out-of-control demonstrations, which would lead to clashes with law enforcement, which would lead to property damage and wildness, we'll call it. And we give the President of the United States the excuse to impose martial law. I think this is what they're after. And the best way to stop them is to moderate the message, not what's wrong. What's wrong is wrong. And they're right about that. But the other side of it, the solutions that they present are absolutely ridiculous. They're killer. They'd ruin America. And anybody who takes the foresight to look into it will find that that's the best thing to do. The last thing that Americans want at this stage is any violence whatsoever. You do not want to give government any excuse to suppress you even more than they have already. And that's very, very, very important. I mean, there may come a time when there's no other avenue left. Well, let's use what's available to us now and hope we can do something with it. And by infiltrating those demonstrations, and I've seen infiltration already. I had a tape in Sandy's issue, a link, a young man. I'll tell you, this young guy, a college student, he knew as much about what's going on as I did. I was floored. And so there are some very bright young people in there going in a normal direction and lending ulterior opinions about what the solutions are to what Wall Street and banking have done. And if you notice, there's no mention of banking and there's no mention of the Federal Reserve. And so that's why Alex Jones has started up Occupy the Fed, which they kicked off this past weekend. And that's a great idea. And so now they have to contend with that. But the government is really scared because they're coming after people like Alex and I all the time, every day. And they're not letting up. And they won't let up, you know, trying to tell people we're not the people that we seem to be, that sort of thing. And it's understandable. These people are in a tough position because if this doesn't all work for them, they're going to lose everything. And their power is the most important thing. And we can take that power away from them. And that's what we have to do.
Well, I certainly think we are on very much the same page there, because that is my analysis basically in a nutshell. I think what we're living through right now is the beginning of the greatest liquefaction of our society since really the big protest movements of the 60s. And I think just in that time, just as in that time, the protest movements certainly did have very valid points to make about ending the war in Vietnam and other such things, but could be turned into weak and ineffectual and useless and ultimately wrongheaded sort of, I don't want to use strong language, but, you know, people who are misguided leading the pack and of course being spun off and having provocateurs sent in there and all sorts of things like that. And of course, that's exactly what we're facing now. But of course, just as in any time of great liquefaction of the status quo, this is an opportunity for us to go in there and to inject real issues, just as you say. And I think it is a question of what we are constructively adding to the debate rather than simply pointing out the provocateuring and the infiltration, because undoubtedly that's going on. But I think it's really the question of what we can bring to the table instead of basically what we can scream about, you know, warning people about the movement itself.
Well, you know, almost all the people who were involved in observing what happened in the 1960s are essentially 63, 65 years old and older. And those people are retired. They're still laid back. They fought their intellectual wars, and most of them aren't interested. So the remainder of people have no idea what went on in the 60s. I mean, I might think it seems like yesterday, but they weren't there. Many of them weren't even born yet, the people in their 40s and 50s. And so they can't see what people like I can see, because I lived through it as a political animal. And the parallels that we're looking at are very, very powerful. And when I see something like Occupy Wall Street come up from out of nowhere, and then you have groups all ready to demonstrate in 50 or 100 different cities, you know it's coordinated, it's well-financed, and it has all the earmarks of what the leftists were doing in the 1960s. They've just gone back, and pulled a page out of the book, and they're copying it.
Well, then on the note of what we can constructively add to the debate, let's take a headline from CNBC.com recently, Occupy Wall Street backs a nationwide boycott against banks. And it goes on to say, in an effort to send a message to big banks, some organizers who are supported by the protesters of the Occupy Wall Street movement. And I think we can parse that sentence for what it really says about who is actually behind this, whether it's the protesters or not. Anyway, it goes on to say they have organized an event to remove all funds from banks and into credit unions. Organizers are calling the event Bank Transfer Day and are encouraging people nationwide to participate on November 5th. Remember the 5th of November, I guess. So what do you think about a proposal like that, which certainly has been sort of floating around for a few years now with the Move Your Money campaign and other such ideas that seem to be coalescing? Is that a constructive way to combat sort of the massive multinational corporations and finance capital oligarchs who are puppeteering our system?
Well, presently banks have lots of deposits and they're growing. Most people don't know what to do with the money, but they're paying off. Many people are paying off their debts, at least the smaller ones. Smaller would be, say, under $50,000. And they continue and this is a very small segment, unfortunately, to pull in their horns. So, on the other hand, switching deposits to credit unions throws an obligation on them to employ the money because they have to lend it out. Now, that may be easy, it may not. We don't know until you get there. But what's important here, look at Congress. Look how controlled they are, paid off by the bankers in Wall Street. I would think that these creatures of those areas would tell the congressman, look, we need new laws restricting credit unions. And ipso facto, immediately, we would see legislation to that effect. And we're seeing quick legislation in other areas, like the last 2 weeks, the discussion in the Senate Finance Committee about the imposition of changes in the retirement 401k IRA plans, and simultaneously demanding. And both these ideas have gone to the full Senate now, demanding that China be forced to revalue their currency upward because it's deliberately been underpriced. And that's true. It's true of a lot of other currencies, too, but China is probably leading the pack, so to speak. And when you have a situation like that, you know that there's cataclysmic changes coming. And why did the Senate do that? And I'm talking about this in perspective of doing it quickly, just like they might go after credit unions because they were getting all the money. And it only took 2 weeks to do that. Most people don't know, but the Chinese stupidly triggered the whole thing in their respect. They banned U.S. chickens from the Chinese market and put 300,000 Americans out of business, out of work, I should say. And so it was time to retaliate, and they are going to retaliate, and there will be a trade war. And it's the best thing that ever happened in the United States under these circumstances. Going back to the retirement plans, I'll tell you, you don't want to be there because they're going to come after them sooner or later. And you're going to end up with a government promise to pay, which they'll never pay on from a bankrupt government. And then getting back to credit unions, sure, on the short term, it's a good thing to do. But I can tell you something, legislation will not be far behind. These people in Congress, 90% of them are bought and paid for. The only way you're going to solve that is to get them out of office. Elect Ron Paul and people like him, put them in the House and the Senate, and him and the presidency, and all of this will stop. And nothing is going to be painless. It's still going to be financially horrible. but it beats living on your knees.
Well, I certainly do agree with that, but I think, I guess, looking at it philosophically, I guess we could say that, of course, they're going to, as soon as there is any coordinated movement to put money into credit unions, they're going to crack down on that and come along with legislation. That's true, but surely that's not a reason to stop doing it or to back off from
doing
it.
Not at all.
I think we have to press on every front, right?
And I'll tell you why. Because you're putting pressure on them, the banks. Now, how many people will participate remains to be seen. But any kind of pressure that's put on the banks is good. Now, that's a give up by the Occupy Wall Street group. The flip side of that will be something on the order of national credit union communes or something like that. They've got something in the background that's going to fill in the other side. They never do anything without a backup. These people are not stupid. They're very smart. You just have to figure out what they're doing, what they're going for, and what would be the end result. And on the short term, over the next 6 months to a year, it's a great idea.
Interesting. Well, let's take a different tack on this, because let me put it this way. If you, Bob Chapman, were suddenly given the reins to the Occupy Wall Street movement and you had all of these throngs of millions of protesters at your beck and call, what would you be doing or suggesting at this moment in time as the five-step plan or whatever it is that you would want these protests to actually accomplish to really affect some sort of meaningful change?
Well, you'd load the other barrel in the double-barrel shotgun. And that is, you go after the Fed simultaneously. That's where it's at. The Fed is the nexus of everything. It's the core, the center, the control mechanism. And it's controlled by the banks and the FOMC and the owners of those banks, who happen to be private persons. And they are not only Americans, they're Europeans, and have been since 1913. You want to take down that edifice, and when you do, you take down Wall Street.
Agreed. It certainly is the Federal Reserve banking system that's behind this. But in specific terms, what are the steps in doing that? Obviously, Ron Paul has been trying to do that for decades, and he's arrived at the point where we're starting to get something approaching an audit of the Fed. I mean, is that the first step? Where do we go from there?
Well, it is a first step, of course. But, you know, if he becomes president, you won't have to go through that folder all. And that's a year away or a year and 3 months away until he would take office. And time is not on our side. And so what you would have to do is immediately find a legal way of getting rid of the Fed. And in doing so, you would take tremendous power away from Wall Street, because Wall Street, in fact, owns the Fed. Not all of them, but J.P. Morgan Chase is the biggest shareholder, and that's caused by mergers over the last 100 years. And then you have Goldman Sachs and Citigroup and other foreign banks, and that would take their power away from them. The power to create money and credit, which should only lie with the U.S. Treasury and treasuries of other countries. And that would be the beginning of the solution. And when you have a project like that, you have transparency in, say, a Federal Reserve subsidiary belonging to the U.S. Treasury, as it was before they illegally changed the law, which was the night before Christmas by voice vote. And where this would all head is a delineation of power. Wouldn't put them out of business completely, but it would take the power out of their hands to control business and industry and everything else. And that power would go back to the U.S. Treasury. And that's not a panacea either, because their record wasn't a heck of a lot better than what we've seen with the Fed. And that's due to influence and corruption. But it is a better idea. We know we don't want the Fed. And there's many people in America who don't know much about anything who now know about the Fed. And so that as a double-barreled approach to the problems of America would be a good way to start. And I think that may be underway because, as I said over the weekend, it was kicked off in Dallas at the Federal Reserve there. And let's occupy the Fed and let's occupy Wall Street too. And let's take the reins of the, we'll call it a movement started by people behind government. Let's take it away from them and let's make it really happen. But we don't want those horrible solutions that have been offered, which are just incredible. I don't know what they were thinking about. You'd think they'd be more subtle. But anyway, I guess they think young people and the disgruntled don't think. Well, they do. There's a lot of bright people in college today. And so I think that's the approach.
Well, I personally am taking with a huge grain of salt any inclination that there has been any sort of official sort of demands from the protesters yet. I think everything that we're seeing is really part of that machine that is being financed by the powers behind the scenes, as you mentioned. And I think what the people on the ground are saying is vastly different. I think there's a wholehearted, concerted attempt to try to portray the protesters in a certain light right now. And I think a lot of the people there are informed about some of the real issues. And it's a question of bringing those voices to the forefront. I think we're on the same page to a large extent with what these protests are and what they signify and where they're going, but really it is up to us. We really do have to take charge and really interject the real issues into this at this time when there still really are, I mean, real human beings out there that can be reached out to, and we can actually win the debate of reason. But as you and I know, of course, this isn't a fair playing field, and we're unlikely to get anywhere near the real goal of ending the Federal Reserve System without the bankers pulling out every trick in the book to try to stop us. What do you envision as the type of things they would do if this movement really did start to turn into a genuine grassroots end the Fed movement?
Well, I think they would send in their agent provocateurs to start violence. If they can't control it, they've got to destroy it. And they would just prematurely get stuck in a decision-making mode where they have to go ahead with something like violence that they hadn't planned for, at least for somewhere down the line. They would be forced to act because if they're losing control of the movement, it's no good to them anymore. So what they must do is destroy the movement that they created. And in that process, they would try to get the groundwork for government to say, oh, this is horrible. We've got riots in 16 major cities in America. And of course, this is hypothetical. And everything is out of control. So we must bring in the National Guard and martial law in order to quell the country, which has turned very violent. And that's what they do. They wouldn't have any other choice.
Absolutely. And for new listeners out there or people who haven't really looked greatly into these types of events and how they tend to play out, I would wholeheartedly suggest that you start to take a look at some of the history behind this, because what Bob Chapman is saying there is definitely not something he's just making up. It's been used time and time and time again in protest movements to try to disrupt things and make the protesters look like violent radicals when they're really not. We've seen that fully admitted by the police forces time after time after time, including, of course, the 2007 SPP summit in Montebello, Quebec, where the provincial police came out and admitted that they had implanted policemen in the crowd to provocateur things. So again, it happens time and again, and it's exposed time and again, but people still unfortunately tend to fall for the trick. And in fact, it's actually just been revealed that in one of these protests in D.C., there was someone from the American Spectator who infiltrated and helped to lead a group of people to try to infiltrate the Air and Space Museum of all places. And he was, you know, starting to incite a riot, and he's actually writing about it openly and kind of bragging about it. So, yeah, we certainly start to see them up to the old tricks, and we just have to be smarter than that and point it out as it happens, because once again, the truth wins against the lies every single time once it's a fair playing field. And at this moment, we do have, as we have the internet, we have your newsletter, we have other resources for getting this information out to people so they can be smarter than what they're trained to be by the corporate lapdog media. So let's get into the Forecaster a little bit and tell people a little bit about the Forecaster and how they can get a copy of it.
Well, Forecaster is about business, finance, economics, and social and political issues all over the world. We publish on Wednesdays and Saturdays by email. Runs around 40 pages each time. We have a hard copy for those who are not on the internet, and everything you need to know each week is in that publication. You can get a free introductory copy by going to theinternationalforecaster.com, theinternational, FOrecaster.com. You can also go to www.intforecaster.com, intforecaster.com. For those of you who want to ask a question, we answer everyone. If you'd like a copy of the publication, or if you'd like a copy of our latest report on gold and silver shares, you can email us. And that address is Bob, B-O-B, at intforecaster.com. Bob at intforecaster.com. For those of you who would like to call toll-free, that number is 877-479-8178. That's 877-479-8178. And in contacting that number, they have a special offer there for those of you who would like to become subscribers. They offer a free subscription, and the deal that they're offering is really terrific, so you should take advantage of it.
Well, not only can I give my own testimonial to the quality of the information in the Forecaster, but I can also add to that the regularity of the Forecaster, because perhaps the exception that proved the rule happened this weekend, where I got an email from Judy saying that the Forecaster was going to be late. There were some technical problems, and then within about an hour or so, it had arrived in my inbox. So, and that was the only disruption I've ever seen in the delivery of the Forecaster. So it is extremely regular, and just hats off to you once again for all the incredible work that you do, and I know you do put a lot of effort and time and energy into this. So I hope people are going to intforecaster.com as well to check the website and check some of the updates and some of your other radio and podcast appearances, because I'm not here to monopolize you. I mean, you're certainly a man who makes the rounds on a lot of different media, so I suggest people check that out as well.
Well, that's terrific, and I thank you very much. And living in the third world has its back drawbacks, but you know, that's the first time that's happened in years. I can't even remember. It must have been 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago that something like that happened. But I guess communications are pretty good no matter where you are today.
Well, we are blessed to be in this technologically enhanced world, and it is a curse in some ways, but certainly let's use it for the positive, because it's a tool just like anything else. But on that note, I think we'll leave it there for now. Bob Chapman, always very, very interesting conversations, so I'm looking forward to our next one next week.
Well, thank you very much, and I promise you, I will be there.